From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The downtown branch of the Atlanta Public Library and Augusta's Springfield Park have something in common. Sculptures created by the legendary artist and sculptor Richard Hunt. With more than 100 pieces in dozens of states, Hunt changed the look of public art in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. The Chicago-based artist's work will be on view at the Georgia Museum of Art on the UGA campus in Athens beginning this Saturday. And Richard Hunt joins me to talk about the show Richard Hunt Synthesis. Richard, good morning.
Good morning.
So happy to have you with us. Also with
well,
us.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Well,
thank
good.
You.
We've got more company coming. This is the curator of the exhibit, Shawnya Harris. Hello, Shawnya.
Hello.
Hello there. So, Richard, I'm going to start with you because you are the man of the hour here. Richard Hunt Synthesis. That name, what is the unifying idea or synthesis connecting the pieces in the show?
Well, I did not give the show the title. As a matter of fact, that will be a good question for Shawnya.
All right, Shawnya.
But I think what is common to all my work, the overarching kind of endeavor is to develop forms using industrial techniques like welding, fabricating, to create things that reflect many things that aren't part of the original technique and material. I mean, they may commemorate historical themes. They may be an active component in a overall design that might combine architecture and landscape architecture. And they might simply be personal expressions writ large.
So, Shawnya, what does that look like? I hear Richard's explanation, but if somebody comes across a Richard Hunt sculpture, what does it look like?
Well, it takes a variety of forms because he's used a variety of techniques over the decades. And I think that's one of the things that we want to introduce audiences to, particularly in the state of Georgia. You know, back to your original point about the term synthesis, I believe that Richard aptly described, of course, you know, his sense of that word. But when I was thinking about the exhibition, I was also thinking about a synthesis of the variety of works over the course of over six decades and how there are, in many cases, they were unique, obviously, because they're unique works of art, but how there's this kind of underlying theme of fusing natural, the natural and the man-made environment and creating these new and unique forms. And so he's, in effect, over time, is synthesizing all of these ideas and all these concepts and into his work.
Well, Richard, I'm curious about your origins. You were born in the 1930s. You've been an artist since
1935, please.
Okay, sorry. I'm going to give you 5 years there.
I'll take the 5 years.
You don't want to be any older than we already are. But tell me, you in your high school yearbook, it describes you as a painter and a sculptor. So when did you start making art?
Well, when I was in kindergarten, so by that time, I was well into it. But in the high school I went to in Chicago, Englewood High School, there was an opportunity to be what you called an art major. Hmm. Thankfully, at that time in the Chicago Public Schools, part of the curriculum included a year of art and a year of music. And if you wanted to, you could be an art major and have a second year of art. And I have to say, I started out like most people, you know, if you're young at it, getting into the arts with drawing and then painting. It's not like you have, you know, metal around the house to start
right.
welding with, or even clay for that matter. But I did start in high school to work actually with clay or plaster to make three-dimensional things.
Well,
another thing was that I took classes on Saturdays and in the summers at the what was called the Junior School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And my interest in sculpture grew even more at that time. I had a particularly engaging teacher that taught sculpture to young people, woman named Nellie Barr.
Yeah. What was it that you saw in her work? What inspired you? You know, thinking for a lot of young people, especially at that time, and especially young African-American, this idea that you could be an artist, was that something that your family supported?
They did, yes. Yeah, I mean, my parents were interested in the arts. My mother, in particular, actually, she was more involved in the performing arts. She was involved with choirs and glee clubs and stuff like that. And as a matter of fact, I spent a fair amount of time with music, but without the success I was able to achieve in art. So I kind of let that fall by the wayside.
And your mother was a librarian, have I got that right?
Right.
And your dad worked in a barbershop?
He had a barbershop. Right.
It's funny because I was reading about Ulysses Davis, also another sculptor, very different kind of work than you, but he was a barber.
Okay.
Is there something about the barbershop, that kind of atmosphere, which are probably very active places that, I don't know, might inspire an artist?
Well, as a matter of fact, one of the things I did on Saturdays or whenever— I worked in the barbershop, sweeping up hair, shining shoes, and then after everything was gone, helped my father clean up after it was over. One of the things about the barbershop is, and being there, it's a community place too. People gather there while they're waiting for their turn in the barber chair. There are a lot of vigorous debates that go on from everything from sports to social issues. At that time, World War II, et cetera.
Well, I'm speaking with Richard Hunt. He is a notable sculptor. He's made hundreds of works of public art that maybe you've even walked past. And there's a show of his work coming up this weekend, or beginning this weekend, at the UGA campus at the Georgia Museum of Art. Shania Harris is the curator of that exhibit. Shania, how about for you? I mean, this is decades worth of work, and you've organized the exhibition. So he's known for these huge metal sculptures, more art in locations like parks and public places than other artists. So how do you even begin to choose from a career like that?
Well, that was very difficult. we could have kept going on and on, but I think our director would have wanted me to stop at a certain point. What I tried to do, with the generosity of many of both our private and institutional lenders, is to get, be able to pull together a sampling of works from different eras, made of different materials, as early as the early 1950s. While he was still a student at the Art Institute, and when he recently had graduated from the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, up until the last decade or so. And the range of materials from welded stainless steel to welded steel to cast bronze objects, other objects that are made, many of the objects are made of found materials, such as car bumpers that he transformed into new forms. A lot of things that may have been discarded in an earlier era now have a new life to them by the way that he transforms the metal into new forms over the course of time.
I wonder about that, Richard. So you started making art out of, I read something about like the junkyard was my quarry, where you would go and find these treasures and car parts. What is it about metal that attracted you?
Well, the the potential to develop a variety of forms. I started out, as I mentioned earlier, first modeling, and in art classes, you'd try some carving. At the beginning of my sort of interest, those were kind of the dominant sculpture techniques. But it happened, in the 40s that this idea of direct metal formed sculpture came to the attention of more and more people in the art world, and certainly people who were or wanted to be sculptors. There was a particular show that came to the Art Institute, to the museum. This was while I was a student there in the college, called Sculpture of the 20th Century. And it had sculpture, from 1900 to 1950-something, done in all kinds of material, but it featured of particular interest to me, the work of Spanish sculptor, Catalonian actually, but who worked in Barcelona, Julio Gonzalez, who was also a friend of Picasso's in those days and then later in Paris. Anyway, he came from a family of blacksmiths and silversmiths and started to use direct metal in making what were sculptures, as contrasted with what we'd know as metalwork or craft metal. So there were some particularly engaging pieces of his and work in metal of Picasso, and there was a young group of British sculptors at the time. And then David Smith, an American, who actually saw Gonzalez's work in Paris and was really taken by it. And it just so happened that he had been a welder in a Studebaker auto plant in South Bend, Indiana. And while he had wanted to be a painter, he had that in his background. And he decided to make welded metal sculpture, which was also admirable and groundbreaking. So anyway, it was seeing those works and others in some other less celebrated exhibitions that turned my attention to the potential of direct metal fabricated sculpture as contrasted with modeled or carved or cast sculpture.
All right.
I've done some of those other things, but my principal engagement over the last 60-some years has been in direct metal fabricated welded sculpture.
Well, hang on to that. We're going to take a little break, and we'll get back with Richard Hunt, who was born in 1935, let's make clear. He is an artist, and his work is going to be featured at the Georgia Museum of Art. Also with us is the curator of that show, Shania Harris. We'll be back in just a moment. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're continuing our conversation with the legendary artist and sculptor Richard Hunt. Among his accomplishments, he was appointed by President Lyndon Johnson as one of the first artists to serve on the National Council of the Arts. His work can be found at different buildings and museums around the world, including a new exhibition at the Georgia Museum of Art on UGA's Athens campus. Shania Harris is one of the curators of that institution, and she is with us as well today. Richard, you were born in Chicago, but your father was from Georgia. Did you visit as a child?
Yes, almost every summer.
So what were your impressions of the South?
Well, the red dirt.
Just like an artist, to pick that out.
My father was born in Hart County, and a few remaining cousins still live there. But he left during what they now call the Great Migration,
yeah,
that they're celebrating the 100th anniversary of, to Chicago. Well, he a number of places in the Northeast, Connecticut, Detroit, but anyway, ended up in Chicago. And met my mother, who'd moved there from rural Illinois, around Galesburg, Monmouth, Illinois. Anyway, in those days, vacation consisted of visiting relatives, either in rural Georgia or rural Illinois. And I enjoyed my time here.
Yeah. Well, your first public sculpture play was commissioned by the John J. Madden Mental Health Center in Illinois. This was installed in 1967. So that's right in the civil rights era. And I'm curious, Shania, about how Richard's work fits into that of other African-American artists of the time, because, you know, as we know, there weren't that many working, or relatively few.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because one of the things that my research and my, if you could say my profession, kind of tries to eradicate is the sense that there was an absence of artists. There might have been an absence of recognition for many artists of color. But there were several artists that were operating and working, particularly in the late 60s. And that was actually a watershed period for many in trying to define their role and their function in relationship to the civil rights movement. And in other cases, just a part of the overall art, world of art itself. I think that Richard stands apart in the sense that he had already been active as early as the 1950s, quite successful, and, you know, was kind of, in some cases, seen to be kind of an enigma because he was, you know, relatively successful, but he still had many of the same obstacles that many of other artists of color had at the time and probably continue to have during this period. But Richard was one of those shining stars. He had early retrospective exhibitions as early as, I think he was in his 30s. One major one at MoMA that took place in 1971, but they had acquired a sculpture of his entitled Arachne years earlier. So I think one of the things that this particular exhibition demonstrates is how prolific an artist such as Richard Hunt is, and continues to be.
And public art is a very particular kind of work. These are huge pieces, a huge outlay of materials and money, obviously. And Richard, for you, you have to, I'm guessing, be aware of where they're going to go. And how do you get yourself in that headspace? How do you think about where they're going to fit in space while you're there in your studio?
Well, let me go back to the beginning. You know, you mentioned the first major commission that I had for this mental health center in
Illinois,
a suburb of Chicago, Illinois, an area that is kind of a healthcare oasis, you might say. On one side of the state mental health center is the Hines Veterans Hospital. Across the street is Loyola University's Medical Center. But anyway, I mean, that's one thing. Then going back to how I ended up doing that, I mean, artists are invited, asked to do commissioned works for either built environments, you know, like a office building, a hotel, a hospital, or in a park. You know what I mean? It's not like a light goes off and you said, oh, I want to put a sculpture there.
Right, right.
Okay, so it turns out that the offer of that commission came from the design architect for the project, an architect named Walter Netsch, who was a partner at the firm of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill.
Well, which, we've heard of that one. That's a
right.
big firm.
Right. So now the thing is, Walter Netsch and his wife, Dawn Clark Netsch, who was comptroller of the state of Illinois at the time, and the two of them on their own were avid collectors of art, and particularly contemporary art, art of young, up-and-coming artists, art of important modern art artists. And Walter and his wife had collected work of mine that was on exhibit while I was still a student at the Art Institute.
Richard, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but we've got just a minute left in the segment, and I wanted to mention that one of our listeners tweeted that they have a wonderful Richard Hunt sculpture in Augusta, the Tower of Aspirations, and lives in a commemorative park for Springfield Village. That's an historic African-American safe community in Augusta. And I'm sorry that we don't have the time to hear that story, because there are so many players that go into putting together huge works like this.
Well, at least we got that point across. It's not just the artist.
Yes.
It's a lot of enablers.
Yes, and enablers like Shania. Shania, what do you think? You know, what are people going to see? What do you hope they see when they walk away from this show?
Well, you know, it's interesting that Richard mentioned his, you know, family's and in his ongoing interest in music, because when we were installing the pieces, you know, they come in all shapes and forms and materials. But one of the things that happened is that people began to break out in dance, trying to
Whoa.
Simulate the positions and the, you know, the forms that he created. So I often wonder, I'm going to ask Richard probably tomorrow when we do our conversation at the museum. It'll be at 4:30. The Georgia Museum of Art, a little bit about if there were any choreography that took place and maybe possibly listening to music while he was creating many of these works of art.
Well, we're going to leave that conversation for your talk tomorrow. Shania Harris of the Georgia Museum of Art. Richard Hunt, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Georgia was once a leader in the oyster canning business, but the last cannery closed in the 1960s. Over the past few decades, the local bivalves have gotten a bad rap. Too wild, too muddy, too much work. So you didn't see a lot of them on menus, but over the past few years, a group of people attuned to the estuaries of Glynn, Camden, Liberty, and McIntosh counties have helped revive oyster farming in Georgia.
I said, this is my last chance. If I can't make it now, I mean, what can I lose? I might as well go out trying.
That is Ernest McIntosh Sr. speaking to our GPP colleagues. His story is one of many told in the new book, A High, Low Tide, The Revival of a Southern Oyster. And author Andre Gallant is joining us now from WUGA in Athens. Andre, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. And also with us, Brian Rackley. He's co-owner of Kimball House. That's a Decatur restaurant known for its oysters. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Virginia. How are you?
Very well. And so excited about this. This is a topic I knew nothing about. And that's something that comes across, Andre. It's a little spoiler alert here. You do reveal that Georgia has a coast. A number of people that we meet in your book get asked about that by people who don't realize that Georgia's 100 miles of coastline offers oysters. Why not?
That's a great question. But I thought it wasn't true for as many times as I heard that from folks down the coast. But then, as I detail in the book, I attended an event at the state capitol where there were elected officials asking oystermen about how the waters down in Apalachicola were treating their oysters. And it just made me realize that a number of folks could use a geography lesson
Andre, about 100 years ago, Georgia's oyster industry was quite robust. So can you take us back to that era? What was going on and what did it mean for the coast?
So the United States has had a historic oyster industry going back decades and decades. Overfishing and development in New York and then the Virginia Chesapeake Bay area caused those oyster areas to decline. And Georgia was well positioned to take up the mantle. And what really helped the state is that there was the invention of steam canning that occurred in the late 1800s that allowed the Georgia oyster, which, as you described earlier, was not quite, it's hard to eat on the half shell like those big oysters up in New England or in the Gulf are, but it's perfect for canning because it's so abundant in our estuaries. They grow on top of each other. It's hard to stop them from growing here. So that allowed cannery after cannery to open. So if you go back to the 1900s from Charleston down to Jacksonville, all those small little communities had little canneries that employed dozens of folks.
And then what happened to the industry?
A number of things. There were some early, you know, health scares. Some people in New England where the waters were no longer safe due to human pollution, some people got sick from eating raw oysters. So that a lot of bad press followed. And then, honestly, people after World War II stopped eating canned oysters. The just consumer taste changed. And then the big thing that impacts the fishing communities here is in the 1960s is that we have changes in minimum wage laws, right? So people working in canneries were usually poor, often African-American, especially in the South, and they were paid piecework. You know, they didn't make a lot of money. And so these new laws come into effect and these bosses, you know, I'll be frank, they can't exploit these populations anymore. And so that's huge. So the canneries no longer have a cheap workforce. And then it just slowly starts to decline as Asian imported seafood picks up.
Brian, I want to go back to what Andre said about this hard to get them on the half shell, this too wild, too much work, possibly unattractive to businesses or consumers. What is the Georgia oyster like?
The wild Georgia oyster is, it's basically just like a muddy cluster. And, you know, we're not so prim and proper that we can't handle a little bit of dirt. The mud's not really the issue. It's just the fact that they're all basically glued together. And in order for you to put them on a tray of ice in a context where raw oysters are being sold as raw oysters, it would require a phenomenal amount of labor to do that. You have to basically just chip them apart with some sort of tool. And we're just not equipped to do that. And I think that for that reason, those oysters have always had a more esoteric culinary purpose. And they just find themselves being roasted in those clumps rather than someone trying to utilize them in a restaurant.
Right. So it's kind of aesthetics and it's kind of habits.
Partly aesthetics, but you really, I mean, to try to just shuck a bunch of clustered oysters and then have someone eat them, it just doesn't make a lot of sense.
A lot of work.
It's just pretty impractical.
Well, Andre writes about every oyster having a distinctive taste. So what does an oyster from Georgia taste like, Brian?
The salinity in the South Atlantic around a lot of, you know, St. Catherine Sound and Harris Neck, I found that it's really good. So Georgia oysters do have a really nice salinity for the most part. You know, obviously weather is a variable that can affect a change on those oysters from time to time. But for the most part, I do find them to be saltier than stuff that's being raised in the Gulf. The Atlantic waters are a little cooler. So the growing season is a little bit longer. It takes a little bit longer to get them to maturity. And to me, I feel like that gives them a little bit of a nuance. But they still have this sort of clean, a lot of times, like kind of a wild spring onion character to them that I think is really neat. And a lot of them will always kind of present like a little bit of a, like a buttery note, which I think is really cool too.
Well, sounds fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, it's an industry that, you know, everybody who's listening to this should be tapping their fingers wondering where it's at. How come it's not here? And, you know, Andre's probably better equipped to answer that question of why isn't it here? But, you know, it's something that people need to know about.
Well, Andre, you've written a lot about people who produce food in the past, and and a high low tide is absolutely in keeping with that. We learn about folks who traditionally harvested oysters. What is life like for a waterman, which is how they're identified, or waterwoman, if we can make that a word?
I would like to be able to use the waterwoman that often comes up in conversations, but here in Georgia, they're just, in terms of shellfish, there are no women working the water. A waterman traditionally, you know, the summer months, they depend on crabbing to pay the bills. And then come October, when usually the water's cooled enough that makes the oysters safe to harvest, they'd start doing these long shifts out on the wild oyster mounds. And this is work that requires a strong knowledge of the tide tables, because you can only harvest the Georgia oyster at low tide because the mounds are hidden beneath the water. So you have to time your commute out to your oyster mounds at the right time, and then you're stuck there. You have to wait there, and you're working, and you're cracking away at these oyster mounds, trying to get them down to manageable, as close to a single oyster as you can. This might be 4 or 5 hours, and some days it might be longer than that. And you're waiting for that water to come in before you get to go home and call it a day.
So that's a lot of work. Let's talk then about the economics of oysters. How big is the industry, and are a lot of Georgians actually able to make a living working the waters?
Well, currently we only have about 10 leaseholders in the state. And so the lease is the area where an oysterman works, and that is controlled by the Department of Natural Resources. And because the workforce is getting a little bit older, there aren't too many young folks getting into it. Wild harvest, there's just not a lot of money in it. It's a lot of hard work. You maybe make somewhere between $50 and $100 for a big, heavy bushel of oysters, depending on your clients. The industry itself is quite small, and it's why folks are so excited about oyster farming or aquaculture coming, because it will effectively double the amount of money they can make per oyster. And it also, because of the way oyster farming is done, it's a much more manageable process. You don't have to always depend on the tides, and you don't have to sit out there under the sun cranking away at oyster mounds. A lot of it becomes more of a gardening technique, or like a tending, instead of this very manually oriented, sweaty work.
I'm speaking with writer Andre Gallant about his new book, A High-Low Tide, The Revival of a Southern Oyster. Brian Rackley is also with us. He's co-owner of Kimball House. That's a Decatur restaurant known for its extensive menu of oysters. We'll continue our conversation about Georgia's burgeoning oyster aquaculture after the break. This is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. For decades, restaurants considered Georgia oysters more trouble than they were worth. But oyster aquaculture is a fledgling movement dedicated to putting more local oysters on the table. Andre Gallant wrote about the eager coalition of people helping to cultivate these briny bivalves in his book, A High-Low Tide. Brian Rackley is a local oyster booster and co-owner of the restaurant Kimball House. Ryan, are farmed oysters more desirable than harvested wild oysters?
In the context of a restaurant that's serving oysters in a raw bar, I think for the most part that they are. I mean, we do get wild oysters that are extraordinary, that have consistencies that are just shocking and surprising. But for the most part, our demographic, I think, has a better response to the cultured oysters, just because you can control, not all of the variables, but you can control consistency to some degree. And I think that people who are spending money like consistency. They always have, and they always will. So it's something that I think is probably just more attractive to them when they see it in a restaurant.
How about the taste? Is there a difference in the taste that you can discern?
Oyster profiles change so much that, you know, if you took a wild oyster and a cultured oyster that were growing right next to each other and harvested them at the same time, you might taste some differences, but you might not. The biggest difference is that a lot of these oysters that are being farmed are being farmed in floating bags, and the wild stuff is sitting in the mud. So depending on the makeup of that substrate, you might get some like earthier qualities out of a wild oyster who's growing in the, you know, on the seafloor, as opposed to something that's growing in a basket at the surface of the sea.
Before you started serving oysters from Georgia, did any of your clients ask why they weren't on the menu?
We haven't had a ton of people ask where the Georgia oysters were. When we first opened, we did have a lot of people ask where the Florida oysters were. But now that question's being answered, I'm kind of encouraging people to ask, where are the Georgia oysters?
So, Andre, among the many characters that we meet, Justin Manley is one that you credit as the first person to farm Georgia oysters. He's now hatchery manager at the University of Georgia Marine Extension and Georgia Sea Grant. So what possessed him to start farming oysters in the state?
You know, well, he moved down here to attend grad school in Savannah. And he was already quite obsessive about aquaculture and oysters. You know, he had already decided to make oysters his life. And he got down here, and I believe he was at an oyster roast and was inquiring about where the oysters came from, knowing that, you know, Georgia does have a coast. You know, he well knew that, moving down from Michigan. And when he found out they were from away, he was flabbergasted because, you know, he could just take one look at our marshes here and he could see the relative lack of development, and just, you know, it was obvious to him that this was prime oyster growing ground.
All of those watermen down there who worked the 100-mile coast, they watched him as he was experimenting with it. So how did he develop his techniques of oyster farming?
Well, his techniques were based on a French method, which is used in various ways. It's essentially called collecting spat, which is the spawn of the oyster. The oysters start spawning in the late spring and do so over the summer. And essentially, he was doing what he does now in a hatchery, but just out in the wild, using plastic to collect little tiny baby oysters and growing them until they got viable, and then moving them into bags where they could grow fat and healthy. And this is essentially just adapting what the oyster does naturally. A wild oyster will just find whatever decent surface it can to glom onto, even as small as a, you know, microscopic grain of sand. And what he was doing, he was just cobbling together a method that was very well in use around the world and in this country already, but because of aquaculture hadn't been introduced to Georgia and was not being allowed due to regulations, he had to do this crazy roundabout way that added hours and hours into his work life. But he was dedicated to do it because he knows that the Georgia oyster is something that should return to prominence.
And you said he began with Spat. The name of his business was, at that time, Spat King Oysters. Mm-hmm. So given all that effort, what's the payoff?
Well, the payoff for him originally was difficult because he had this, like I said, roundabout way he had to do that. You know, it was a little more time intensive than what is becoming traditional aquaculture methods. The payoff for him didn't work out for him because, you know, he lived in Savannah, wasn't living quite the waterman's life, and had to walk away from it because of different expenses.
Your book reveals a whole system, not just the people who are harvesting or farming, but the researchers, the aquaculture scientists who work collaboratively with harvesters to make the Georgia shellfish business competitive. That is a really tense relationship in some places. Brian mentioned Damariscotta. Up in Maine, the lobstermen and those who study and maintain the fisheries there is a pretty contentious relationship. How does it work in Georgia?
I think you could describe it as contentious because watermen, they're a special breed. Folks who work the water are tough and they're opinionated and they don't like to be pushed around. And, you know, because they're dealing with a food business, they have to deal with regulators, right? And then there are these, you know, the university researchers who are, you know, they have PhDs, you know, where these guys went to the School of Hard Knocks. So they don't quite see eye to eye on everything. And so what that means is that someone working in extension like Justin Manley has to kind of, one, tread slowly and speak a special language. And I think it helps when folks who are trying to aid in the industry have experience in the industry like Justin did.
So Brian, for you, a lot of your business, I would imagine, is about the relationships with those who are farming. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it is for me. To me, I just feel like when you're selling a food that people are eating raw, I mean, you should always be aware of the risk and the dangers of eating raw, any sort of raw protein. But you know, I just always felt like we could eliminate some of the risk variables by knowing who we were buying from, knowing knowing what type of steward they were, and knowing how they treated their lease. And I just feel like that at this point in time that we, you know, it's my opinion. It's not everybody's opinion, but yeah, I mean, I think Kimball House has the best oyster list in the city, if not the Southeast. And I don't think that that's because I'm capable of picking up a phone or sending an email. I think it's because we work with the best farmers.
I imagine you could talk about oysters for a really long time just from hearing you.
Yeah, I could go for a little bit.
Why do you think oysters have become this symbol of wealth and classiness, you know, for lack of a better word, that if you see a movie scene and they're trying to depict that it's a fancy party, it's oysters on a half shell?
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that I struggle with, because I wish that it was a food source that was not alienating from a price standpoint. And, you know, hopefully that's something that we can sort of work through as the industry gets a little bit more mature, and we're looking for ways to use oysters differently. But yeah, I mean, you know, one of the biggest differences between wild oysters and cultured oysters is the fact that you do have to make a pretty large investment in equipment and seed and those sorts of inventory items. And it's not without a considerable startup cost.
It makes me think of the Irish satirist Jonathan Swift wrote, "He was a bold man that first ate an oyster." And I think in 2018, we can safely say he was a bold man that first farmed an oyster. Andre, this revival surely didn't come easily. But is it a revival? How far along is it? Where do you think the revival of the oyster farming along the Georgia coast is now?
Well, I think you can say that a large boom is set to begin, and it's just waiting on some regulations to be rewritten. The DNR is moving slowly, and I think some would say far too slowly, in changing some of the regulations that would allow oyster farmers. And they're doing so because they want it to be right for our marsh, which, you know, I can respect. But I think for the folks who are ready to start making a living and ready to invest, it's moving a little bit too slowly, because especially when you can look one state over in South Carolina that just as rapidly is leapfrogging us in terms of aquaculture. But the other element in this is the workforce, because they're, you know, rural populations. You know, when we're talking about the coast, we talk about Savannah, but we really are talking about tiny, tiny, tiny little towns that don't have a lot of places for folks to work. And young people are leaving. They're leaving in droves. And it would behoove the state to get oyster farming set up as quickly as possible to give some lifelines, one, to these young peoples and entrepreneurs. And this industry could still tank unless we get people willing to devote their lives to it. And I think, you know, the other half of this equation is getting people who, like Brian said, not just a bunch of rich folks in here, but people who are, you know, authentically of the Georgia coast and have a lineage in the marshes. The McIntoshes, who we heard from, are a great example of this, and they deserve great success. And I think there are other people who can, you know, and fit a similar bill and get promoted by the state and really put us back on the map.
We heard from Ernest McIntosh Sr. Ernest McIntosh Jr. is also in the business. Right. What can you tell us about their family business?
The Harris Neck is one of the most fascinating parts in the state to me. It has a long history dating back to the time where white people used enslaved people to create wealth. And that lineage is alive in the McIntosh family. And they've been living on this land, which is in the northern end of McIntosh County. And working the land and working the water goes back generations. And so what we have is Ernest McIntosh Sr., who's about 65, and his son, Jr., who is 32. Ernest Jr., you know, went off to college and tried to make a life not doing the family business. And a couple of years back, made the decision to come back home and work alongside his dad. And sadly, that's one of the only examples we have of that tradition being passed down from father to son or father to daughter or young people getting involved. But I think what they embody is kind of what's really wonderful about Georgia, about the history of this place and kind of the promise of those communities down there.
How many commercial oyster farmers are there now in Georgia?
There is only one commercial oyster farmer, and that's the McIntosh family.
Wow.
There have been some people who are involved provisionally, but there have been sicknesses and deaths and various holdups. And, you know, honestly, because the state has taken as long as it has in rewriting it and holding up the launch of this industry, so the McIntoshes are pretty much working under a provisional permit right now. So people aren't sure if it's going to actually happen.
What are the restrictions or regulations on oyster farming and aquaculture in Georgia now?
Ooh, where do we start, Andre?
Yeah, so the big thing is, as Brian mentioned, you know, when we're talking about oyster farming requires gear. And that gear is plastic cages. Sometimes they're metal, but they can be quite large. A popular system is called the Oyster Grow system, and it's about 4 feet by a foot deep by 3 feet wide. And these have to set in the water. And so in the minds of DNR, this becomes a water hazard, right? So probably the number one user of our marshes are sport fishermen, right? So they're out there on the weekends or in their spare time boating through the marshes, casting for snapper or whatever's in season. As it stands, that's a bigger industry than oyster farming, right? So they kind of hold a lot of sway, the sport fishermen. And so what the oyster farmers need is rules that allow them to put this gear out in the river that's, safe for recreational boaters, but also is promoting an industry that, you know, has every right to be there.
Brian, we're hearing about some of the regulations, and you now work with the nonprofit organization Oyster South, seeking to advance oyster aquaculture in the South. So what are you identifying as the kind of obstacles that remain before the industry can really take off?
The Department of Natural Resources needs...
That's the DNR here.
Yeah, they need funding in order for them to be able to perform the federally mandated testing that will allow aquaculture to succeed here. So there's got to be some legislature that will put a little bit of money in the Department of Natural Resources pockets so that they can have the resources they need to make sure that that testing is being done. And then, there's got to be incentives. There's no incentives right now for people to farm oysters in Georgia because they can't float equipment. And if you can't float equipment in those marshes, it makes it really, really tricky to farm oysters. And that's why you're not seeing a younger workforce charging into this type of industry. If you look at the farming demographics in Alabama and Louisiana and Florida and the Carolinas, I mean, you know, there's definitely people that are doing this as sort of like their retirement gig, but there's a lot of people who are doing this who are in their 20s and 30s because, I don't know, I mean, I think that they're nostalgic for an industry that they've never even experienced. And some of them are really passionate about it, and you can tell they're going to grow great stuff. The proof is already there. I mean, we've been able to taste stuff by people who are really maybe their first, second, third crop of seed, and they're already growing great stuff. And they're learning new techniques, and you can tell they're just going to get better and better. So, there's got to be a reason for people to want to do it in Georgia. And right now, the inability to float equipment and the leasing system is a bit antiquated. Until those things are amended to some degree, I don't think you're going to see a lot of people taking a risk on it, because right now it's a risk that seems to have a little bit too much downside.
Yeah, I mean, Brian mentioned it. You know, to get started in this business, especially if you aren't the McIntoshes and you don't already live close to the water and aren't already working the water and own a boat and have all this stuff, I mean, you're talking about a minimum, and I'm going to be very, very kind here and say like $50,000, you know.
That's very kind, Andre.
Yeah, it's very kind. I mean, we're talking about to get started for a young person or, you know, even a middle-aged person to go down there, you gotta put a chunk of change in there, so... There's absolutely no reason to invest that and to buy the gear, to buy the boat, to buy the walk-in coolers, to do all of that until you know that, you know, you're going to be able to harvest and recoup those expenses in a year or two time.
Well, Brian, Oyster South, the organization you work with, they have a big event coming up this weekend, Landlocked. So yeah. What does an event like that do to let people know about oysters in the South and to help stoke this healthy market?
In an environment like this, we try not to be preachers. I mean, you know, we'll give a couple people the mic for a couple of minutes to talk. But it's mostly about giving people the opportunity to come to an event like this, meet tons of farmers from around the South, see who's actually growing this stuff, meet them, see what they're about, and then taste those oysters in a couple of different contexts, one being a raw context and the other being, you know, at the hands of some really great chefs who are going to be outside cooking these things on big green eggs.
Well, Brian, just before we go, Hurricane Michael hit the coast so hard, the Florida Panhandle and also in Southwest Georgia. I'm wondering what you're hearing from your suppliers about what's happened to them and the Carolinas for that matter.
Well, it's been a rough few weeks. The Carolinas, the farmers in the South made out okay, and some of the North Carolina farmers did as well. But a couple of them did get beat up pretty bad, and they're still recovering, trying to put the pieces together. Florida has not been quite so lucky. A lot of the farmers, what they do is they will sink their gear They basically just take it off the lines and, mm-hmm. and just put it in the bottom of the ocean. It's really the only thing they can do at that point when a storm like that is coming through. So then
they lose it.
No, they don't necessarily lose it. It just sits at the bottom. They lose some of it via mortality. And what we had, especially with one farmer who I've spoken to, is that he lost just about all of his seed. So that's why I think that landlocked and what Oyster South is doing this year is really important. The plan is to start a new Oyster South program called Seed Bank. And what we are trying to do is find ways to incentivize and encourage and offer grants to people who are trying to go into the commercial hatchery business, because I heard this over the weekend several times at the Southern Foodways Alliance Composing. If you want to free yourself, you got to be able to feed yourself. And you can't do that without seed. And so I think if this is going to be a perpetually successful industry, we've got to have more farmers who are in a position to hatch their own seed.
Brian Rackley, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Brian is co-owner of Kimball House in Decatur, partner in the nonprofit Oyster South. Andre Gallant, thank you so much.
And thank you very much.
Andre Gallant's new book is called A High-Low Tide, The Revival of a Southern Oyster. Both Brian and Andre will be among those sampling the fruits of the sea at the Oyster South event, Landlocked, this weekend. So for more information, you can go to gpbnews.org.